Hey guys, welcome to Totally Unrelated. I'm your host, Adrian Cosby. Welcome back, welcome back, welcome back. Welcome back. I'm not going to punish you with my singing, but I do want to say thank you for tuning in, and thank you for all the extra follows. A lot of you guys went down after that last episode, after I suggested that you hit that follow button, and you did, and I saw it. It went up, and thank you. If you have not done that, please do. If you don't want to, don't. But this is what it does for you. This is something that's probably not hurting your life. And if it is, I'm thrilled. But I equate it to this analogy. I used to be a smoker, if you know anything about me. Go back to the last episodes if you haven't, or don't. But I used to be a smoker, and I was the kind of smoker that never bought a carton of cigarettes. I was the kind of smoker that only ever bought a pack occasionally, if it was buy two, get one free, but never buy three, get one free. The only time I ever bought a carton of cigarettes or more than one pack at a time is if I was buying cigarettes for somebody else. I say that to say this. Liking or subscribing to the podcast is actually buying the carton of cigarettes. You don't have to smoke them, but you will at least have them. You'll know that they're there. You'll get updates when they come out. You'll be the first to know. A lot of people like to listen to the podcast in as close to real time as possible. I'm one of those people. If it gets to be 2 weeks since that podcast has aired, I typically don't go back to listen to it unless the guest on it or the topic is something I'm really interested in. I do encourage you to go back and listen to all of my podcast episodes because, well, they're all fantastic. You'll definitely see a learning curve going, and one of them is right now I'm actually editing in Adobe Sound Booth, which is a much more advanced editing tool, and I've been playing with it all day. For instance, I started editing this podcast at about 11, no, it was about 10 o'clock this morning. It is now 4 p.m. And yeah, that's what happens. That's what happens when you're learning a new format, but I think it's going to work out just fine. I'm working on some distances from the microphone. You might hear some variation in that. I might be able to edit it out. I don't know. It's like being a wizard, though, working with this editing, because you can literally work with magic. For instance, the interview that I do with Linda is outside, and I've realized I want to limit my outside interviews. The birds are just too much to deal with, but I did a good job, I think, of reducing that background noise. If you could hear the source file, everything in the background is about as loud as we are, and I did a pretty good job of narrowing it down to just her and I with some background ambient noise going on. So I hope it's not too much. I hope you enjoyed. It's definitely a great interview. When I hit the end button on this episode from recording it with her, I remember thinking, damn, that was great. So, she's a real person with real life experiences, a real comic, a real headliner. I hope you enjoy the episode. I want to give a shout out real quick. We did Wiley's last night after the podcast. We walked over to Wiley's. I closed out the show. She did a set in the middle and saw some really good comics last night. Joe Clausen was back on the scene. Very funny. Had been a while since I'd seen him and doesn't look like he's missed a beat at all. Joe Robinette, I've been seeing him around. Had never really watched his set, but very funny. Really killed with his set last night. Benny Elbows, funny guy. Andrew Ruddick, man, this guy is going to be famous one day. Don Smith, that's the funniest I've ever seen you, man. I'm not dissing you by saying that I saw you when you first started and it was hit or miss at best. But last night you really hit him, man. You really hit him. Very funny. Carl Z, from China, funnier and funnier every time I see him. He goes, very intellectual humor, very funny. And of course, Nate Washington, always hilarious. Karen Jaffe, always funny. And there was people on there that that performed that I didn't get to see, or you just weren't fucking funny. So no disrespect. I'm just saying I didn't watch everybody, or you weren't funny, and you don't know who that is now. Scotty Mays, great job hosting. Thank you for all the posts you guys put on Facebook for the show, and that's a great way to promote. You know, you can do the invites, you can do all of that stuff, but the best way to promote a show is to actually call your friends on the phone and invite them to the show and tell them that if they come out, you'll buy them a drink. And take away the barriers to excuses to have a good time, and people will thank you for it at the end. If you don't have those kinds of means to buy somebody a drink, then help them move. Give them an IOU to help them move furniture one day. And I guarantee they'll thank you for that too, because I just had a couch delivered and the people that moved it in, like one of the guys was very agreeable, but the other guy was acting like this isn't his job. He was like, hey man, he's like clearly African. He's like, hey man, you got to help us, man, because of the way this is. And I was like, I don't have to help you with anything, but I will, you know, so we didn't hit it off right away. And then it came completely wrapped in like plastic and styrofoam and all kinds of shit. And they're like, do you want us to take the plastic off? And I'm like, yeah, I want to make sure it's exactly what I ordered. It was ridiculous. I mean, it was almost borderline ridiculous. Ordered it from Macy's. They're like, somebody may call with a customer review questionnaire or something. I highly doubt that that's going to happen, because the first five things on that customer review list, they didn't do. So it's probably just a way to make you feel good about the fact that they're not going to call and ask about the customer service. So, yeah. Once again, I'm not talking about anything that's happening in the news, but if you don't live under a rock or in a cave, you've probably seen that the news is singularly focused. I offer you my Facebook page for a comedic respite. Not me, but two of my favorite things that I've seen today. Just tool over to my page and scroll down a little bit. You'll see an American Ninja Warrior video and a video clip from America's favorite TV show, The Office. So check both of those out. You will laugh. I laughed out loud in front of my computer. And that's what heals the world. Shout out to my social media homie, Glenn the G-Child Childress. If you want to tune in to social commentary about whatever's going on in the news, I find this guy to be exceedingly hilarious on Facebook with his posts and social commentary. Glenn Childress, he's a friend of mine, so if you're a friend of mine, you can just look him up from my page. But check him out. Always funny. Always witty. With that out of the way, guys, I'm going to bring in this next episode. Working out has been awesome. I want to say that real quick. Thank you to all my MyFitnessPal friends. That last episode was awesome. We'll do it again later this week. I'll post on there, and I'll post on Instagram and Facebook about the hotline. But guys, if you haven't tried, call the hotline. Leave me a message. The phone number is 336-422-6729. You can call and leave a message. It rings about four times, and then you just leave a message, and it's like that easy. It's no problem. 336-422-6729. One more time. That's 336-422-6729. Okay, now, let's do this Linda Belt interview, and then we'll wrap it up. Thank you guys for tuning in. I love you. Stay unrelated. Yeah, we got safety. Yeah, it's all good. Yeah, we got everything here. We got security. We got a tree.
We have Michael. Yeah, security.
We got.
I left my sunglasses in the car because I thought I was going in. You see.
That's.
And now people might recognize me. Where you're incognito now.
And see, I got the mirrored lenses, yeah. So people can't see that I see them seeing me.
Yeah, but I could see myself. So if I need to fix
true.
I'm good.
True. And I won't take glasses. That as into like put your readers on and then look deep into my eyes. Hold on, let me look at your face, baby.
My readers. Michael, do you have your readers? Yeah, we're so funny.
I know, it's just, it's like I'm a day away, because all my friends that are 41 have.
Really?
Yeah, especially the comics.
Oh my God, I was close to 50.
Yeah, okay, then I guess I can say
I've had a while there.
Hopefully.
I made it to 15.
Okay.
Yeah, 40s, yeah.
Mm, okay.
Not ready yet.
All right, well, maybe I take better care of my eyes than those losers. We're sitting at the trolley stop here in the Oregon District, Dayton, Ohio. I don't want to say that this is a vacation spot for you, but you do seem to vacation here frequently. Because I guess when you live Connecticut closer to the water,
yeah,
coming inland.
Well, you know, I'm here to visit my boyfriend who lives here.
Who's sitting right over here, but who cares about him? We're going to say it's something different.
I do, but that's a good way to look at it. It's a relationship vacation, but instead of a relationship away, a vacation away from each other, it brings us together. I know. I mean, couldn't he have, like, lived in San Francisco?
Palm Springs or something.
You know, a nice...
On a cruise ship.
Or on a yacht. Beach.
Yeah, yeah.
I had a reconnect with a man I met 26 years ago.
Oh,
and
wow.
Reconnected with him.
Here in Dayton?
We met in New Jersey. He was working for Peugeot Car Company at that time, and it was a Wednesday night. I remember it because it was a ladies' night.
Ladies' night, what a night. I was out in the mid-80s
with my big hair and my shoulder pads and all that, and I was out with the girls. Well, one girlfriend who went on the dance floor and left me.
And then I saw
this cute guy, and I heard he said something to the bouncer. And I turned to him and I said, "You're not from around here, are you?" Because I heard that little twang.
Yeah, yeah.
That little twang was Cincinnati.
Ah!
Twang. So...
Born in Cincinnati, Mike? What hospital?
Maple Knoll.
Maple Knoll. He's old.
We can't all be Christ-like.
We're old, you know, you're talking to... he's a distinguished gentleman. See, women are called ma'ams, but men get to be called distinguished gentlemen. So we reconnected 26 years later, and at that point I was a comic.
I was a comic. When you met?
No. When we met, absolutely not. I was working in New York. I was out of college. I was working in New York for a personnel agency. I started comedy 12 years ago when my kids were in middle school.
Really?
And I needed to get the hell out of the house because I was a stay-at-home mother for 15 years.
So you were the punchline story.
I was. Little Sally Field.
Yeah.
Not quite as dramatic. Club that had lockers that always cracked me up.
I know.
Because I'm like, can you watch my pocketbook? I wish the clubs had locked. But I remember seeing that movie. But my whole background was acting. That's what I did in college. I wasn't a theater major. But I always loved comedy, always. So my background was acting. I had done some improv, and I did comedic acting, you know, with a script, of course.
Sure,
and
sure.
I did plays, and if I had auditioned, I'd get a comedic role. But having been a stay-at-home mother for 15 years, I just said, they were middle school. I go, I got to get the hell out of the house. So a friend of mine in Hartford was retiring from comedy after 20 years, and she was doing a mic locally.
Uh-huh.
And she said, come to the open mic. She didn't tell me to come and perform. She told me just come at the audience. So I watched, and the night I went, there was one woman. There were six comics total, five guys, one woman. This one poor girl was so bad, poor thing. I just turned to my friend next to me, and I said, on the worst night of my life, I have to be funnier than this.
Yeah.
So I said, I have to try this.
Yeah.
And then the rest was history. So no, when we met back then, and then of course life took its course and I got married.
Yeah.
Not to Mr.
Right.
Cincinnati.
Right.
You know, he went off and
the Cincinnati kid.
Cincinnati kid. He went off and he was married to somebody else. And I got married, had my two kids. And then when we reconnected at that point, I was a comic and I had a gig in Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
And he drove out to see me because I was at Fort Wayne. And he
I know where Fort Wayne is.
6 years we reconnected.
Wow.
And I was going through a divorce.
How far into the divorce were you when you reconnected?
Well, actually, we reconnected online. I hadn't seen him, and we hadn't spoken at that point, like 25 years.
How was that? Was that like, hey, what's your sitch? Or was it just like, hey?
No, I found him on Facebook, and I said, are you the same, Michael
Cincinnati
so-and-so,
kid
right,
that I remember?
Who I met
that sweet twang.
In the early 80s, exactly. And I was just filing when we reconnected. In fact, he had been married and divorced twice, and here he was telling me to to try to reconcile if I could. So I was getting all this advice from this man I hadn't seen in 25 years. Exactly.
That's amazing.
And so I had, I had just...
So did it ease, complicate, expedite the divorce process, or was it just like a smooth divorce? Or
oh, it was anything but smooth.
But like having this man candy on the other side of the rainbow, did that soften the blow at all?
He became my best friend.
Yeah, yeah.
He became my best friend through that. And having gone through the process, told me what I was going to be in for. And remember, this was all long distance.
Mm-hmm.
This was just somebody, you know, being a good friend, you know, through the process.
Yeah.
So that did help, but it's always complicated. And I was performing through the whole thing, you know, because the divorce was going on, but it never stopped.
Did the comedy have anything to do with the divorce?
No. Mm. Nothing, no. Not at all.
That's good.
No. In fact, the comedy probably saved me. It was in terms of being therapeutic.
Prolonged, let you get out.
Yeah, it got me, and it was therapeutic, and because I tell the truth on stage,
mm-hmm.
I incorporated... You mean you still want to be respectful because
right.
I have two kids.
Right.
To this day, I talk about it somewhat. And I was even thinking about putting more stories in that are the truth.
Because
50% of people getting divorced.
It's
you're
relatable.
Not the only one.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know,
it's
they're
totally
sitting
relatable.
There going, I can relate to this. It's relationship.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and who can't relate to that?
I agree.
If they haven't been through it, they have a friend or family or somebody who has.
Yeah.
So it's relatable. But no, the comedy had nothing to do with it. We were, I don't know, we were probably doomed early on, but I stayed 23 years.
Yeah.
But I have two great kids.
When did you know? 13 months. 13 months I knew, stayed 23 years. No, it's...
I knew two years in.
Yeah, I think it's also one of those things that you get married young. The younger you get married, the less cooked you are as a human being. And then, you know, you get fully cooked, and then you might realize, as a fully cooked human being, that you're a completely different person than you were at 21 or 22 when a lot of people get married.
I was 27, almost 28.
Me too.
And he was 31.
Okay, so you
so
had a
we
pretty
were
good
not,
idea.
Yeah, it was just, you know, circumstances. Unfortunately, I think for women, especially of my generation, we were the ones who were, you know, this was the late 80s.
Mm.
And we were the ones who were taught, oh, you can have it all. But yet we still were, I was petrified of turning 30 and not being married and not having my first baby. So we were that generation.
Right.
Who was, you know, we felt that biological clock.
And if it doesn't happen
ticking,
now, it might never happen.
It might never happen. And it was weird. I mean, and I, you know, I have a 24-year-old daughter now, and I'm glad that she doesn't feel that way.
Yeah.
And I'm so relieved that for, you know, her and her friends, they feel so differently.
Yeah. There's no rush. You know, there's no free lunch in that regard, because a lot of younger people, they don't have that old school, you know, get married, kids before you're 21, kind of a thing. Buy a house, you know, get a, you know, if you're not going to college, get a job, then go to college, get a job, or drop out when you meet your husband, or whatever. They don't have that stress, but they also have this thing where they do go to college, and then they come out, and they're like, well, I want to be vice president or CEO. And, well, what kind of experience do you have?
Right.
I thought I'd be valuable because this is my first job.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And so, what I think we had in my generation, or at least I feel like I was the last generation, your generation probably much more steeped in this, but I went to work like once I could pull a lever. You know what I mean? Not like in a factory, but I was hustling. I was had a paper route, I was babysitting.
I was babysitting at 12 and 13. I had my first job at 16. I was a waitress in a, I don't know if you remember when drugstores actually had lunch counters, lunch
ads. Yeah, I almost forgot about that.
I was a waitress in a drugstore. Oh, that was great.
Can you imagine today?
Even back then, the people
that I... Zoloft smoothie, please.
Yeah, the people that I would meet back then, the customers, it was a riot. Looking back now... You know, when I think about...
Do a time travel right there. Take a drugstore owner. Like, well, how can I sell anything if I don't have a bar with a restaurant?
We had Sundays.
Yeah.
Ice cream.
Phosphate or whatever.
And that's where I started. So I was a waitress, and then I worked my way up, and then I went to college at 16.
Really?
Yes, and I graduated at 20.
Good God.
So I came out young. I graduated high school in 3 years instead of four, and I had skipped kindergarten. So it kind of it put me 2 years ahead.
How long till you were headlining after you started?
You mean
like from first open mic to first headline gig?
Well,
first official headline gig.
I was just gonna say
qualifier.
Hashtag qualifier.
Well, of course, I booked a show probably 6 months ahead and headlined myself, which I had no business.
Where's Saturday Night Live? Give them my number.
Which I had no business headlining, and I look back now, and the funniest thing though I did, Adrian, this was the best thing, and I would tell new comics, I tell them to do this. Do tape yourself early on, but thank God back then there was no YouTube or all the social media.
I'd say the
because
same.
If I had posted these crapola videos, oh my God, I was like a harsh.
It's a double-edged
sword.
But
of course, I thought it was so hilarious.
Yeah.
And I actually paid to be taped, and this will date me right here, but I have the VHS tapes. And
oh well, yeah,
I
that's
can't
not
even
bad.
Watch
if you had it on
those.
Betamax,
yeah,
that would be.
Mm. But I would say the first, official, probably 5 years.
So maybe twice as
earlier.
Fast as the average person.
Yeah.
You knew it was fast.
I'm going to say I moved pretty quickly, and that wasn't like planned or intentional. It kind of happened.
But you started late.
I was 44.
Okay, so you were already...
My first open mic, I was 44, so I had two things really... I had every card stacked against me. I had my age and I had my gender.
Yeah.
I was a woman, and the third thing was I was not in a major city.
Market,
I was not in New York, not Boston, not L.A., you know,
close.
Not a close.
Yeah.
Hartford did put me right in the middle, and I will say there was a benefit to that.
Yeah.
And I tell comics this, don't always go running to New York so quickly because I got more stage time outside of the city than I would have in the city.
Mm-hmm.
I think sometimes if you're in the suburbs or outside of New York, I got more time.
So it's also more quality time as far as like
time.
Relatable. Sometimes in the city it's much more of a...
Well, they do
shotgun.
Multiple gigs a night. The
city is
you can do a 6 o'clock, an 8 o'clock, a 10 o'clock. So you can get... You can get better quicker, and they move. They do one club, but the city
But here's the thing I think about the city, I guess, and I'm not trying to disagree with you, but I think that what I found about the city versus the road is that the road is the reality of a comic, and the city is like a privilege. Like, to be able to work in just one city.
Yes.
To doing, like, 6 sets a night, but you're still going home every night. Like, that would be a huge privilege.
That's
not something that everybody can
and
do.
And that's why, even now, I'm just 2 hours to New York.
Yeah.
And I'm often asked to go in, oh, can you do this show? But the thing is, you get to a point where you have to make, I'll go in and do a show in the city. But really, when I'm going into the city, it's more to see my friends and visit. And my comedy friends in the city, because I'm going to be very honest here, the money is on the road.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're at a certain point, I'm 12 years in now, I have to be very realistic about things. And you have to determine what your goal is. And if your goal is, if you're starting out in your 20s and your goal is television or your goal is late night, it's a goal game. For me, I kind of had to rule that out in the beginning. Because by industry standards, that wasn't their view or perception of me.
Yeah.
So I had to be
realistic
about that.
It's amazing to me how, like, I used to watch The Golden Girls because it was on, like, basically, so Saturday night for me as a child, I'd say 10 to 17, 10 till I could drive, was Saturday night, I'd take the TV that we had hooked up to our computer. The TV that was hooked up to our computer keyboard, right, that we could use. And I put it in my room, and it was just countdown to Saturday Night Live. I'd watch all the shows on all the different channels in order. So it started with, like, Golden Girls. Then it went to GLOW, Gorgeous Ladies of Wrestling.
Oh, my God.
And that would actually run past Saturday Night Live. I think Golden Girls came on at 10 to 11, and then I'd start watching GLOW from 11 to 11:30, and then I'd switch over to Saturday Night Live. But this is also growing up in a house full of women.
Yeah.
I also realized I watched Mama's Family.
Carol Burnett. That was Vicki Lawrence?
Yes.
Vicki Lawrence. Yeah, yeah.
I was watching. I was jogging, like, I've seen this
episode.
You're
jogging some memories here.
I mean.
But you know what Golden Girls proved? What that show proved was that sometimes the network executives were, you know, doing their marketing were a little off base. Thinking that the only people watching television are people between the ages of 18 and 35. And the other thing is, when I was growing up, when I was younger, I liked the older comics. I thought the older comics were hilarious. And so now, I will tell you, I don't care what the clubs think or what the bookers, I will tell you what I know. What I know is that here I am, a woman in my 50s, and some of my biggest fans are 20-somethings, 30-somethings, who will come up to me after a show, oh, I loved you, oh, I get the, oh, you remind me of my crazy aunt, or, you know, or I'm like the mother, if that mother, like, was, you know, off color.
Right.
It's like my mother, you know, she dropped the F-bomb,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
So, because everybody can relate to that persona, that character, and it's just real life humor.
Sure.
So when industry dismisses a comic because of their age or gender, I'm telling you, they could think what they want, but I know what I know. And they're off base.
Yeah.
They're off base because I just, I don't know, I've proven they're off base in the emails I get, you know, just the people will come out to see my shows. I have a funny story about that. I was doing a Turning Stone Casino, New York State, near Utica, New York, not too far from Syracuse. And I get a call from the booker, because they used to have a Wednesday night, every Wednesday night show. And I had a, got a call from the booker, the office called me and said, Linda, I just want to let you know that what's going to happen Wednesday night? One group bought out the whole room. One group bought out the whole room. It's a group of seniors. So I said, oh, my demographic. I'm like, oh, this is going to be. She goes, no, it's a college. It's the graduating class. It's the class of seniors.
It's a group of seniors.
It's a group of seniors.
Oh, perfect. It was turn the mic up.
So,
I'll kill them. And so
I said, well, Lorraine, are you calling to replace me? And she goes, oh, God, no. Because I know you're going to handle them.
Yeah.
She goes, they're going to think you're a riot.
Yeah.
And I wasn't insulted if she wanted to replace me and, like, give me the following week or... And then I get this email that said, this is a Catholic college, and can you tone it down a little? And are you kidding? Once I got there, they were, you know, and we did. But we had such a good time.
Yeah.
Afterwards, they wanted to dance with me and party with me in the clubs. And there I, you know, turned into the mother. You're not 21. What are you doing in here? You know.
That to me, I'd say this. There's two things that make me really, really happy in comedy. And that's doing well for young people and doing well for older people. You know what I mean?
Well, the key is to be universal.
Yeah.
And is somebody always going to be my demographic? No, because I can be asked, I'm not insulted when I'm not the right comic for a show.
Me too.
And part of being a professional is knowing when you're not the right comic for a show and not taking every gig. And when you get to that point, that's one of the biggest mistakes that newer comics make. And I tell them, you might hear, take anything and everything. No, wrong. Do not take anything and everything. Because if you do that, all you do is, if you're inappropriate for a show, especially a fundraiser, a private event, you screw that up, then the following year, that venue never wants to do comedy again, and you've just really have done a great disservice to the,
comedy itself. I think so, and I also think that, you know, that onus is really on the person booking the show to do their research.
I agree.
You know, we know people don't, or they want to help their friend or family. They think comedy is this thing that they know because they've seen it on TV. But it's so much different than that. And I've always found, this is the advice I give, is very similar. Like, but it's, I'll say, you know you've matured when you know that you can say no to things. Sometimes you'll say, I could say no to this, but I'm going to take it to challenge myself to do well for this thing that historically has not gone well for me. Or you can say, you know what, I'm just not the right comic for that.
Yeah, and I do a lot of private events, a lot of parties, bridal showers, you know, and so on. And I got a couple of calls for bachelor parties. And when they called me, I'll say, you know, first thing I say is, are you sure?
Yeah.
It's, boy, can I get you a guy? You
yeah,
know,
yeah.
And two of the responses I got were, no, we thought it would be funnier if it were a woman, because I turned it into a little bit of a roast. I'll ask something about the groom. And then I have to write that material.
Yeah,
it's my
yeah.
private events. I don't write a complete roast.
Right.
But I just ask for some basic information about the guest of
You're
honor.
You're a funny person. You'll get there.
But, you know, and then I'll just say, but if I, but I ask. I'll say, are you sure? Because, boy, have I got the guy for you.
Yeah.
There's also nothing wrong with saying two things. Either, you know what, it's not my genre, it's really not what I'm the best at, let me make a referral. Or the other thing I do is if I'm booked, I'll say, I will help you find somebody. Because I want them to have a good show.
Sure.
I never just say, if I'm asked for a date, no, I'm booked, and let it go. I don't do that. I go, give me your date, I'm going to help you find somebody.
Right.
And I'll make sure, well, if it's not me, then I'll help you find somebody to make sure that you have a good event.
That's important, I think, because I've been saying to bookers now, when they say, you know, if they're challenging me to do something, or if they're asking me to do something I haven't historically done before, like or something like that, mm-hmm. I say, look, it's more important to me that any show I'm on be a great show. I don't need to be the highlight of any given show. So there might be a show that I'm going to be a better MC on. For instance, Chris Kattan came to town, and he does this show where it's Chris Kattan and friends. And they asked me to drive him around, and you know, I was going to get feature money to feature for him, but there would be four or five comics on each show. So,
well, he does it more like a showcase.
It's like a showcase, and then that way these younger comics.
Sounds like a good show.
It's a great concept. It's a great concept because, like, you know, I might not go see Chris Kattan, I might not go see Jimmy Joe. But Jimmy Joe's my cousin. I'm going to go see Jimmy Joe because he's opening for Chris Kattan. Now, that's a show I can go to. And that's a great bill, right? So that's what we did all over Ohio. And but when we got to each of the places, they were like, okay, so you're going to feature. And I was like, let me host. Let me host because I know I can do that probably better than most people can.
Well,
and
hosting
that's really
is a skill set that a lot of clubs undervalue.
Well, because it's the lowest paid
it's
spot.
It's lowest paying, and it shouldn't be. And the other thing I've learned is, like up in Boston Comedy Festival, every year, they have headliners host mm-hmm. those showcases. Mm-hmm. Canada, it's the same way.
Yep.
Canada, the host makes more money than the feature.
Well, what I love about that concept.
They put more emphasis on, because you're setting the whole tone for the room. And so when I
it's a beautiful thing, because it'd be like Linda Belt has brought you these comics that are her friends, and she has blessed them. She's, you know, the sword. And so, like, now the audience, because they love you, now they're going
to
love your friends.
Show.
And you get to go up and be in.
It's funny you say that, because I used to book a show up outside of Hartford, like one Saturday a month. And when I was in town and not booked, you know, on another gig, I hosted all my shows. And people came to expect you.
Yeah, yeah.
It was like expecting Bob Barker on
The
Price is Right.
Right.
You know, when he left,
sure.
It's like, what happened to my show? You
Absolutely.
Know, like, you Monty Hall, let's make a deal. Like, you got used to a certain host.
Yes.
And the nights I weren't there, the owner of the restaurant would be, oh, they missed you. So-and-so asked about you. It's like, they were asking, oh, where's Linda? You know, more so. Because they expected you, they look forward to seeing you. You became a personality
sure.
in that room
sure.
that they expected, even if you just got up and did, you know, 5-10 minutes of just talking.
Which I think
to the
is, which is what, like, the phenomenon of podcasting is sort of about. It's like, it's a regular thing. You know, I think when I first started doing this podcast, my original idea would be to do it like an audio version of The Tonight Show, where I would have multiple guests, multiple segments, kind of a thing. And then as it's evolved, I've realized that, like, I don't want to do that much editing.
Yeah.
And I do a considerable amount of editing. So if this episode takes an hour, usually takes me about an hour to get it up.
because I go through and I listen to it and I make sure I level the peaks and stuff.
Right.
And then I think, you know, when I first started in comedy, I was shooting all these videos because I got this high-def video and it made everybody look amazing, like you're on TV or in a movie or something. And then I got to this point one day where I was editing somebody's five-minute video and it was just terrible. They were just not funny. And I thought, I'm getting really good at editing these things. Like, I'm juicing, like, where the small laughs are. I'm boosting that audio or whatever. And I'm like, I'm about to get out of comedy to become a video producer. So I stopped doing that.
Yeah.
And then I was like, one of those things where it was just like, you know, there's so many sidetracks that you can get caught up in being a comic. Like, different things that you could venture off into.
Oh, yeah, just the videos on social media.
Yeah. That I thought, like, if I could just get the...
And it could take so much of your...
Energy,
it could take so much...
life force.
It can take so much away from the actual performance.
Yeah.
Because somebody can be a YouTube hit or something. But good, I want to see them get on stage. And I want to see them do, you know, some of the shows that I might do where I'm asked an hour, no cursing, no this, you know.
When you can
and
turn
I'm like,
crowd,
I want to see, I want to see this big YouTube sensation, you know. Like,
well,
you know, do that. Because it's one thing to do that, but it's one thing to be live on stage, two different things. But even just, even talking like this is great because I think people don't realize how serious comedy is.
It's just like every other job. It's just like every other job.
And they just think you're always on and you're always, and they don't realize what we do and what goes into it and the writing and the performance and the variations and just, you know, it's not cookie cutter. Like, not every show is the same show.
No, and it's not, and it's not one of those things that, you know, it's like the union and it's not like the union. Time in does matter, but it's like, so like in construction, if you are in the union, you know, you come in and you're low man on the totem pole. You might be great at your job, but you only get this many hours because Fred's been here for 30 years and he's going to get those hours first. But after a certain amount of time, then your time in plus your work ethic will yield a better result for you than maybe a guy that came in at the same time as you. But, you know, time in does matter, but at the same time, it's like you got to be able to sit there and realize that this is a race against yourself. And I think for the layperson, they think, oh, you know, my cousin's doing comedy now. He's a comedian. I saw him at the comedy show or whatever. And then you're like, yeah, oh, you know, well, is he going around the country doing comedy or whatever? Like, oh, no, he just works here, but he's very famous locally or whatever. And it's like, I know some people that are infuriated by being compared to somebody like that. And to me, it's like, we're all in the same union. Some of us are journeymen. Some of us are entry level, you know. We're not all going to retire from this union.
Right. And the other thing is I say to people who want to start and they ask me for advice, I say, listen, the first thing, probably the most important thing you have to realize is not everyone will move to the pro level.
Yeah, yeah.
The chances, most won't.
Look to your left, look to your right.
Exactly, and that was the thing. If you had asked me 12 years ago at my first open mic, if I ever thought it would become my career, I would have told you were crazy.
Really?
But I got in the car with my friend who had gone with me that night, and she looked at me and she goes, I hope you know that your life from this day forward will never be the same.
Yeah.
And I said, what are you talking about?
Was she a comic?
No.
No. But she knew.
Civilian,
yeah.
Friend.
Oh, wow.
Family, and she said,
she saw the blood on your teeth.
She said, you were so comfortable.
Yeah.
And so natural. You had no idea.
She saw it.
And she saw it.
That's a beautiful story. That's a really beautiful
thing.
And
I just was like, what? And she goes, yeah. And then I just, the other thing I would say to people is put blinders on.
Yeah.
Be nice. Don't burn bridges. Be as professional you can at all times. Don't disparage your fellow comics. You know, even when you're the one being disparaged, do not go down that road. Do not burn bridges. You will never know in the future. Someone you don't work for now, you might work for them later. You do have to, at a certain point, I did at a certain point, have to draw a line in the sand because, as again, a woman and as an older woman, I was not going to be put up with the discrimination I was getting, and either I had to draw that line in the sand. No, I was not going to be relegated to host and feature forever because I'm a woman.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to fight, you know, the headline. when I shouldn't
have
had,
what do you got, Mike?
When I shouldn't have had to fight, I had to fight sometimes too.
Yeah. Well, you know, we everybody know, anybody that's in the comedy business knows it's a completely different venture or game. I don't want to say it's a different game. Let's say it's, if male comics, if the comedy for male comics is like the game of Sorry, whereas for females, it's much more like Monopoly. For men, more forgiving. Whereas,
that's a
like
great
with
analogy.
Women, I just thought of it.
Yeah.
I thought of it as it was coming up. But with like women, a certain number of you are going to fail based on. A certain number of women are going to fail based on your success because they decided to quit and not fight because of how much more you were taking. Because
I was older, and I think, you know, I look at the girls, you know, in their 20s, and I try to mentor them. You know, if I see talent and they reach out to me, I really try because I can't imagine. I wasn't there.
Yeah.
I was older.
Yeah.
And a little more worldly, so I knew how to speak up.
For
myself and speak up and just tell these
get,
guys.
That's what you get as an adult.
Like, are
having
you kidding
worked other
me?
Jobs,
you know, like I had no problem. Even recently, you know, speaking up to bookers and saying, mm-hmm. no, this is what I do, and if you want me, this is my fee, and this is what I get. It's kind of like, if you act a certain way, you're going to be treated
act
a certain
as
way.
If. Act as
act
if.
Act like
been
a headliner,
before,
you're going to be, right. If you're going into, what's the saying? If you get into the, what is that? If you get into, if you have the touchdown, if you make the touchdown, act like you've been there before. Right.
Can you believe?
Don't act like this is unusual. Like,
right.
You know.
Well, that
like,
was what I got out of, I get that out of a lot of inspirational movies, like the movie Rudy.
And like, oh, he gets, I love that movie.
Yeah, it's a great movie. He gets carried out. But he's just such a piece of shit through the whole movie. You know what I mean? He's just such a piece of shit through the whole movie. Entitlement and but it's a thing that, like, I think hard work has this byproduct of entitlement, and especially in comedy, it's hard to define what hard work really is.
Well, I just went, and I'm sure, you know, I meant it because it was just like an out loud.
We've all heard it.
Because in my head, I'm thinking about all the people who try to cut the line.
Yes.
You know, they're like, well, Lynn, if you have this show, can I open for you? And I'm like, how long are you doing comedy? You know, you're doing comedy a minute.
Right.
You tell me you can do 30 minutes. My big question is, of you know what I ask of your 30, how much is funny? How much of your 30
what's
is funny?
What's not filler? Yeah.
Yeah, and it's this.
There's 29
not
minutes of prop
wanting
work.
To pay your dues, and you have to. What makes you think, you know, you can cut that line or
it's,
the?
You wouldn't know that. It's like that same thing we were talking about with the younger college kids.
Yeah,
you know, they have
like
this,
it's your
free
first
from
job,
the,
and
from
what makes
the,
you think you're going to be CEO next week? Like, there's this, dude, and especially when I started, here I was not in the city. I didn't have any friends, really, in the industry. You know, there was nobody, you know, club owners, you know. It was just so, I didn't even have the right quote-unquote connections, you know, and I had to do it on my own, and it was just hard work.
I know two kinds of comics right now and that I started with, and those are the ones that are better at the promotional end of it and put more energy into that than they do into, like, the actual development of their act, and then I know guys that are terrible at the promotion aspect of it and write voraciously and perform at every open mic. But for whatever reason, it's like, you gotta be able to, I realized this when I was in college, and I only went to college, to be perfectly honest. My wife found this out in a podcast, who paid for my college, that I was just kind of hiding out so I could practice comedy, you know, without having an excuse for not having a job, right? So I'm getting my degree, if comedy doesn't take off, I fall back on this $20,000 I just spent. But if not, then I get to spend 40 years trying to recoup that $20,000. So, it was one of those things when I got out, it was like, I was very aware of, because I had tons of other jobs, that this was an apprenticeship. You know what I mean? I'm gonna have to watch a blacksmith for 150,000 hours before I even get to touch the red hot iron. And then I have to act like I know what I'm doing once I do touch it.
And one of the other, you know, if any newer comics are listening, what I would like to say is one of the biggest mistakes they make, and I tell them this all the time, they'll go to a pro show on a Saturday night, hang out with their buddies, and they will leave the showroom when the headliner is on. And I, biggest mistake you can make as a new comic, because I don't care whether you like that comic's act or not. I don't care if you sit there and go, oh yeah, what the heck, what is it? Let me tell you, so there's a reason they're headlining, whether you like their act or not. How they respond to the audience, how they respond to a heckler, the crowd work, just their cadence, the timing, their persona, whatever it is, watch them. It's big, one of the biggest mistakes I see. They go out and go talk to their other open mic buddies, you're not going to learn from them.
It's an Amway lesson.
You have to talk to the pros.
It's an Amway thing that they used to say, where they'd say, I'll take another drink, yeah. They say, I got pitched Amway when I lived in Hawaii by a guy I didn't know.
Amway, that's yeah. another
right,
one.
That's a thing from our generation.
But I went to one of those.
I'm having a party at my house this Saturday.
Know.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I didn't
come
know.
By. All my
yeah,
friends
exactly.
are coming. There's,
I got that.
Why is there an Eastland at a Whiteboard
yeah,
up there?
Yeah, we want to talk to yeah. you about a new opportunity. In
have
the first
some more dirt. Sit down in one of the chairs, all facing the same direction. It's not... Once you get into that situation, it's a horrible situation. But I remember talking to the... to this guy, and he's saying, you know, do you want to be wealthy? Do you think you'll be wealthy one day? And I said, yeah, I think I'll be have as much money as I want. I don't necessarily think that's an abundance compared to the average person, but I think I'll be able to not worry about it. He's like, well, let me ask you this. How many of your friends are millionaires right now? None. I was 22. And he's like, well, then you need to, you know, your odds of becoming a millionaire are like less than 1%, because most people that have $1 million knew people that had $1 million before they had $1 million. So you got to change your sphere of influence. If you want. And I thought, well, that's kind of ridiculous. You know, my dad's a doctor, my mom's an attorney. I'm fucking technically a Huxtable. My last name's Cosby. And, But
is my drink safe?
Yeah, your drink is
okay,
safe.
Okay, I'm just checking.
I know, right. You got a high tolerance. I've been popping them in there, but geez, you haven't batted
them. I just wanted to know, because I have security here. Okay.
I understand, yeah, yeah. Hey, Mike, go take a walk. I'm working on her career. I'm going to be a mentor for a few minutes. The thing I think that I found out at the end of it all, though, was, what was the whole train of thought we were talking
about? You were talking about being... when asked, did you know a millionaire?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Also, the whole Amway pitch. The whole Amway pitch,
yeah.
Which was, you know, throw away your friends, start up this thing, have social networking, and you're you know, you could be a millionaire within, because you know millionaires or whatever. And I thought, so let me ask you this. So is this something you think everybody can do? And he said, yeah, I think everybody could do this if they put the work in. And I said, well, cool. Because I don't want to be involved with anything that anybody can do. You know what I mean? Like, I want to do some shit that, like, only 1% of the people can do. Not because it's so glamorous or because it's so hard, but just because it's not for everybody. Right. And I knew that at that point, like...
And when you think about what we do, how few people can do... I mean, there are people who claim they can do it.
I know people that I think could do it, and they say they can't do it. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
my sister is... We're both comedians, and... She doesn't perform. She did. She has.
Oh, she has.
But she doesn't. And to me, it's like...
I think my son could do it. They both did. But my son and daughter did improv. They were both in the improv troupe in high school.
Okay.
Both actors. Very talented. My daughter more improv and acting. My son can do stand-up. But you know what he said to me? Mom, I can do improv. I don't know how you stand up there alone.
Wow.
And I'm just the opposite.
Yeah, yeah.
I'd rather be alone and just have my script.
Yeah.
You know, and not have to bounce off of other people.
Sure, and I
know,
started, I came
yeah.
to comedy through indirectly.
I started to improv too, but I don't think I could do it now.
Well, once
could
I went you? To in, once I did stand up, I was like, thanks
like,
guys, bye.
Right?
Yeah, I hate to break
could
up with you.
Could you be in a play? Could like you be handed a script? Because my whole background was acting.
I did
acting in college, and after college, I did go to acting school in New York. I don't think I mentioned that, but I did go to acting school in New York.
Did you do any like major years. Productions or anything?
No, off Broadway.
Yeah.
But I, if you gave me, and you know, that's how I got the courage, by the way, to go to an open mic.
Yeah.
Was my kids were in a play.
Good.
My kids were in a play, and it was Hartford Children's Theater. And when I brought my kids to the audition, the director said to me, "By the way, I want you to know that your kids told me you have an acting background, and I want you to know that we cast adults in adult roles."
Oh, wow.
Would you audition? And I did, and I got a role. So it boosted my self-esteem at that point and put me back on stage. It had been years.
Yeah.
And then I did the open mic. But it's like what you say, there's so few people who can do it. But I give anybody credit for trying.
I do too. I think
even if they fail.
It's the hardest thing just to go up there. It's the hardest thing to walk up there.
You never know.
The first time I did an open mic, I remember I was so nervous. So nervous. And but as soon as I grabbed the microphone, I was like, this is what we're doing. This is what's happening right now. And like the nerves just went away and I just talked into it. And even now I find myself at times, even now, I'm like saying these jokes. And I'm like, did I write this? I'm like, so lately I've been thinking this thing, like, am I in the Matrix? Because I feel like my life is this thing where I'm like, wouldn't it be cool if, and then the next thing I know, I'm doing it. You know, and the next thing I know, I'm 5 years I've been doing it. And I'm moving through it with velocity. I wouldn't say ease, but faster than some of my peers.
Yeah.
And I think, is this really real? Because, you know, I'm about to go on the road for 7 weeks straight, but at the end of that 7 weeks, it's a wasteland. You know, my calendar looks like Mad Max, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so, but it's, that's been the reality every year.
That's the nature.
That's the reality every
year. Yeah, yeah. I love saying that.
It only goes 6 months and then you're going out of business unless, you know, you send the emails and the emails come in. And all
well,
this other stuff.
Lucky for me, like I said, at this point, 12 years in, besides clubs, a lot of my work is private.
Private. And which pays so much better, too.
Pays so much better, so I could have one private gig that will pay me three times in that 45 minutes what I would make an entire weekend in a club.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what makes up for me. Although, you know what I miss with the private? The camaraderie of working with
other comics, yeah.
Yeah.
Anytime somebody ever approaches me for those, I always, even if they're like, we just need 45 minutes, like, let me bring somebody to do an MC spot, kind of warm up the crowd a little bit, and then bring me on or whatever. Just, and it's not because I can't do it. It's because I want to go with my friends. I don't want to have to go to and from a place by myself. Because you know as well as I do, man, the first couple of years of doing comedy, those road trips are what it's all about. They can be 5 to 10 times more entertaining than the actual gig.
That's where I've met some, you know, comics who we've become close friends.
Yeah.
As a result.
Yeah.
You know, meeting Kenny Smith out of Dayton.
Kenny Smith was the first guy to ever take me on the road.
Do you know, Kenny and I met for the first time. We worked together at comics in Rochester. Now, who knew how many years later that I'd be coming
Rochester.
To Dayton and have this connection with
Kenny
Dayton.
Smith.
And we should, to this day, Kenny and I have so many inside jokes about sharing this condo. He never met me. I never met him.
Yeah.
And we just spent the week howling. And then when he came to the Hartford, I went up to visit him, and you know, we said, but you just make these connections. You can work with a comic, not see them for 5 years, see them 5 years later, and you still have this connection. I have to say, in 12 years, most of my experiences have been very positive. I've had a few comics who I would prefer not to work with again.
Right.
Nasty, mostly guys who I think were just hate women, and I don't mean just I think women in comedy.
Right.
I think if you scratch the surface on the men who do misogynistic humor on stage, like I think if you just like scratch below that surface, that's just not comedy.
Right,
I think
right.
those men truly hate women. And they will let you know, they will remind you, it comes out in their humor. It just, those guys I can do without, but I'm not going to blame just comedy. The problem with being a woman in comedy is it's not a problem, it is what I am.
Right.
Comedy.
Right. Challenge.
In fact, a challenge is my whole gender gets blamed.
Mm-hmm.
You'll hear someone go, you know, we had a woman 5 years ago and she sucked.
It's the same thing black
not,
people
experience. Right, exactly. So we're not hiring a woman again.
Yeah.
Which, can you imagine a club going, we had a guy 5 years ago and he sucked.
Yeah.
So you had one woman who,
midgets,
so you had this one woman who wasn't funny, but thank you, so my whole gender Sugar's point?
Yeah.
Why didn't you just book a woman who was funny to begin with instead of putting on the token,
you know? It goes both ways. I did a benefit show at an animal shelter charity in North Dakota with a headliner who... This is a testament
to me.
Boy,
that sounds like an awful one.
It was kind of awful.
North Dakota. Right there, you got me.
A one-nighter.
A one-nighter, North Dakota.
But it was a string of these charities that this guy was stringing together. And they were fun.
Those animal fundraisers, by the way, those are good audiences.
Yeah, they are. They're great.
They are great audiences.
I never had a bad show.
I agree. Same here.
But we're doing this, and we're at the hotel, and there's a rock concert, like, happening at a different venue or whatever. But these people, the headliner's, like, on the second floor, and I guess they're partying in the hotel, like, really loud during the daytime. And he wants to sleep, so he opens the door, and he almost gets, like, in a fight with all these heavy metal guys, because he's like, hey, can you keep it fucking down? I'm like, dude, you asked the front desk for a room change. You don't fucking talk to the people. You don't talk to those people.
Yeah.
And then we get to the club, and there was some guys heckling or whatever, and then he starts kind of going, after the show, he starts going off on, like, the book, not even the booker, just the lady who's in charge of the charity. Like, you need to police the room better. As if she was running a comedy club. Like, this was the one-time deal kind of a thing. And I thought about it for a second, and I was like, you know, some people are just never satisfied, or, you know, they're going to be, I don't want to say a diva or, you know, whatever.
Yeah, but difficult.
Difficult.
And
it's a fine line for a woman to not be too agreeable.
Right.
And then you say one fucking thing, and now you're difficult.
Exactly. And we're accused of being a diva.
Yeah, you don't do women anymore. Linda was here last week. She asked for ice in the water.
When I close, I got one of my pet peeves, and I just think it's based on experience, is I don't like more than 45 minutes in front of me.
Yeah.
Because I think the audience is exhausted.
Amen.
When I see this hit parade of this, like, amateur hour in front of me, I'm like, no. And that's the first words that come out of my mouth. And I always hate to say it, but I always preface that statement with, I don't mean to sound like a diva, but I'm going to be.
It's going to come across like that.
It's not that I don't want to not let the comics have their time. That's just something I see a little difference with in the Northeast. The Northeast, we have our... is a standardization of an industry standard of shows.
Mm-hmm.
Little different than what I see in the Midwest.
Sure. Yeah.
In the Northeast, it's like kind of host, feature, headline. And it's like 15 to 20, 30, 45.
I call that the New Testament of comedy. You know what I mean? It's kind of like, this is how it was
so
written.
So you telling the Jew what the New Testament is?
Well, I'm just saying,
it's the oldest.
Well, I mean, I feel like your people developed it. I feel like your people developed the 15, 30, 45 method. And people that interrupt that, I'm like, this has been written before you were born.
Right.
This is a true, tried and true. It's the same thing I had at one of my best friends.
And everyone tries to take credit for that.
Yeah, I know.
It's like
I had the first 15, 30.
When I was up in Canada, it was like, you know, Yuck Yucks. He was the one who did the, you know, was this one invented the 15, 30, you know, 40.
It's the comics,
like, everybody
that don't
wants to
that, you know,
say,
like, we don't have times here. It's a show up, go up, and if you've got 20 minutes, do 20 minutes. You know, I hate...
No. It's first of all, stick to your time because you don't understand the audience. You're exhausting them.
Here's what it is.
People have a attention span.
And we said, pinky.
We said
it's an attention span, but it's what I call it is, it's like an attention span versus your time investment, right? So how much time am I invested in? So I think in those situations where guys like, I just want to do the show all night long and everybody does as much time as they want. Like, here's what would be a better idea. Run the show in hour-long segments, and if you have guys, they only have 5 minutes, put them in a chunk of time with a guy that's got 20 minutes. You know what I mean? Like, you have to do some coordination. But with no structure and no value to the audience member, they've given nothing to the show, therefore their return on investment needs to be zero. Mm-hmm. Which means they're going to be talky, they don't even care that it's happening.
Exactly.
But if you tell them, hey, we've got 10 comics that are coming this hour, and we're going to take an intermission, then we have another show that's coming at this, then they can get up and leave at the end of the hour if they're like, this isn't really for me. Maybe new people come in and sit down or whatever. Structure trumps
anarchy and comedy every day.
And I tell people this all the time. My private events, by the way, I do contracts.
Yeah.
I will not do a private show without a contract. And my contracts will stay due to copyright, you know, reasons. There'll be no videotaping. You know, the audience will be told, silence their cell phones. The audience will be told, please take phone calls and texting outside the room. And sometimes these people, I mean, this could be a 50th birthday party or a bridal show. And they're like, really? Like, I'm telling them what to do and they're the ones paying me. But here's my response. My response is, it is my job as a professional to give you the best show I can give you. And I know what I needs to be in place to make this work. Comedy is not a performance that you stick in the middle of a three-ring circus.
Yes, no.
And I know what it takes. And then our people will come back to me, and those are the when I get a review, an email, a that is one of the first words that comes up was, I so appreciated your professionalism. That word is so important to me. Because if you say my name, there are two things I want people to equate with my name, is professional and funny. Funny, professional. You know, you can interchange
either
one.
I'll tell you this. I've been telling bookers in the last 2 months, fuck the funny. I'm professional. When it comes to, like, did this triple thing where I had to send in more paperwork, like, before doing the show than any gig I've ever done. But I've never worked with them before. If I had, then I would have had this. So, but I send it all in, and I get an email back a couple minutes later, like, I've never had anybody send this in without me, you know, threatening not to pay them. Like, you actually sent it in 2 weeks, you know, before the gig started.
That's what I did.
I was like, I thought I was late doing this, you know? She's like, no, it's just commendable. And I said, hey, I'm all business.
Well, that's the thing, you know, I tell people show up, you know, the newer comics, show up. Well dressed. I don't, you know.
It doesn't matter how funny you are if your business sense sucks.
Right. And, you know, just be professional. Show up sober.
Yeah.
You know,
which is a lesson,
you know.
Show up drunk 6 times, shame on you.
Right, right.
I told people my new thing is, like, I quit drinking before work. I still drink when I get there, but, like, I found that it's like people frown on it when you show up with a drink in your hand. And that's,
I don't bring a drink on stage. Now, you and I are imbibing, right?
Yeah, yeah, we are.
But we're talking about a show starting at what?
Like in an hour.
An hour.
And we're not going up. We're going up in like 2 hours.
This will be metabolized.
Oh, yeah, this is
right.
Dinner, really.
But this is dinner.
Power.
But what I'm saying is, I will have a glass of wine for dinner, but when I'm doing a show, especially a very high-paying gig, never. I do not drink before I go on stage. First of all, my age. I need to remember what the
my
act is. You know,
right.
I need to remember my material.
I find drinking on stage to be similar to that of being...
I've never done it.
Really?
My entire career.
It's
two things I haven't done, by the way, and I just want to get this out there. I've never done a bringer. 12 years. Never did a bringer. My entire career.
For the people listening, like a bringer...
All right, it's your show.
So let me make sure that we have the same definition of bringer. So bringer meaning a show.
You can't get on stage
unless you bring X number of people.
Exactly. Never did one.
Never did one of those.
And those are huge in New York.
That's huge for every comic, I'd say, for the first 2 years of their career.
Never did one. My entire career.
So it can be done.
It can be done. And I'm living proof that it can be done. And that's why I wanted to say that. So if there are any newer comics listening to this, I want you to know I went from open mic comic to headliner without ever doing one.
Well, I would say this then.
But I'm not, what I'm saying is everybody has a different journey a different route.
Yeah.
But don't ever let a venue think that your career is dependent upon that.
Sure. So, yeah, I would say this then in that regard, in that... some comics put a lot of energy and effort into doing festivals.
They're fun.
They're fun, but I don't find... Well, okay, I can only say this because I've only done one, and it got me nothing. You know, I turned
down... Do you want to say which one, or you don't want to be negative?
No, it doesn't... I don't have to be negative because it was fun. It was the Cape Fear Comedy Festival, and a lot of comics know that it's a lot of fun because it is like a big hang. It didn't get me anything as far as work is concerned. I met a lot of people, and I had a good time. And
even
some bad things happened. But here's what I'll say is that I've gotten everything I've gotten without doing any festivals, and I know some comics that have done upwards of 20 festivals that start at the same time as me. And I think, like, whatever somebody's path, like your path of never doing a bringer, my path of doing one festival, and I don't see myself doing a festival again. I can't say that. I did two festivals. I did one that I paid to submit to and one I was invited to. And that second one that I was invited to paid me and gave me a hotel, and that pretty much ruined me for getting to another festival ever again, because the one I submitted to and paid to get to, I ended up spending about $1,500 that week.
You know which ones I like? The ones that are not contests.
Right.
I did Detroit. I don't even know if they have it. Detroit gave me an entree to the Midwest. That's how I got the gig in Fort Wayne.
Through Castle, or?
I was at, Mark Ridley's Comedy Castle. But the booker of Sneakers, she saw me there, contacted me. She said, when are you gonna be in the Midwest again? I'm doing Asheville in August.
I'm so jealous.
Asheville is not a contest.
No.
And when I wrote to them and before I submitted, I said, what I find very attractive about your festival is the fact you're not a contest. I cannot tell you, stress enough, as a comic, how attractive I find that. Detroit was not a contest. I did one in...
Cape Fear wasn't either.
I did one in... Canada. I had a blast in Toronto. I made such good friends up there. I met the owner of Yuck Yucks. As an American working up there, that's a whole different ballgame. Because he wanted to bring me up there, the owner of the chain.
Yeah.
But you have to go through work permits.
It's a very
different ballgame up there. But
let me ask you this before we get out of here, because we do have to wrap up here soon. You mentioned Snickers. I know that they closed recently. And when I was looking at the thread, one of the comics, I know he doesn't listen to the show, so I could say his name, but I won't. But the one I was talking about.
We're professionals.
Right. I'll tell you after the show.
You're my kind.
Yeah. I'll tell you out there. He had a really great post, and while I say he is a bit of a diva, he is hugely funny. And so this is what was funny about the week I spent with him, and all these complaints that he had about the whole thing.
I probably know him.
He was on Conan on Tuesday. I was with him from Wednesday till Sunday. He had Conan on Tuesday. Never mentioned it once. Never mentioned it from Wednesday till Sunday that he was going to be on Conan on Tuesday. And I thought, now that's a goddamn professional.
Yep. Yeah.
It just didn't matter. The guy, the people he was riding with, it would have been such an overbrag that we would have, I mean.
Well, it goes the other way, too. I love when I'm on a show with a guy and he goes, you know, I was on Letterman. And my response is, okay, and tonight you're on this
gig
with me. Yeah. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Yeah. Tonight you're at the White Front Lodge.
Right, and tonight, like, yeah, and tonight we're on the shit gig together. And gee, I'm headlining, and you are.
I used to have that same thing when I played soccer with these guys that were like, I tried out for the MLS. It's kind of depressing to even be here. And I'm like, I can imagine, dude, because I didn't even go to college. You must feel like shit.
Right.
You haven't even scored any goals this season. Well, I have five.
Well, we can sum it up by saying, for our audiences, when your audiences see you, they don't really care where you've performed, where you've been, who you are, whether they've heard of you. You're only as good as your last show.
Exactly.
And if they haven't heard of you that night, you want them to leave making sure they never forget you. And that's how you build your fans.
I agree. I think if you can do well, like you were talking about the YouTube comic or the YouTube fame people, let's see how you do tonight, you know, whatever. To me, it's like you can do a certain something for people that came out specifically to see you. They'll be entertained or whatever. But what I found doing shows with celebrities is that that aren't comics, that aren't steeped in stand-up, that's when I get the most comments after the show.
Yeah.
Wish you'd been up, you know, longer or whatever. Yeah. It's one of those things where it's like, thank you. That's not what this was about tonight.
Right.
You know,
exactly.
But
if I'm asked to host a show, first of all, I will ask for headliner money.
Yeah.
Because if they want me to bust that room open, they're paying Linda Bell. They're paying for my persona. That's what they're paying for.
I have a gig this week where I couldn't ask for more money, but I got the nice room.
Yeah. And that's what I tell them. But that's not my job. It's a headline.
Yeah.
If you want me in that role, in that lineup, that's my job.
So, yeah, I would say that my message is, like, I love to MC. I love hosting a show.
That's really, really a skill set.
It is.
That I'm not good at anymore because I haven't done it in a while. But I used to be.
Well, what I'll say is,
because I did it.
What I'll say is, I know there's a time that will come where I won't be as good at it as I am currently. Because when you move into that headliner phase, from that feature to headliner phase, what I find is that it's much more relationship building. And as an MC, you're a used car salesman. But not all used car salesmen sell cars. Most of them don't. But there's one or two guys at that lot that could sell anything to anyone.
It's just their shtick.
It's just their what they're good at. So it's like, I know that once I move from selling the car off the lot into like getting somebody to buy multiple cars, because what a headliner does is you're buying the fleet. Let me talk to the guy in charge who's buying 12 cars. I don't need to talk to the guy buying one car, because as the headliner, no matter how good the comics were before you, you got to get them all. There's no excuse for the headliner if you don't get
them
all.
And the thing is, in New York, if you're a great host in New York, your name is probably mentioned more.
Yeah,
there was a killer host the other night. I love her. Lori Graves. Shout out to Lori.
I mean, just like her stage presence is
killer.
Is like that of.
And I had this conversation with her.
It's like a cross between Roseanne and Sam Kinison.
Yeah. Wow, what a compliment.
Right? Yeah. I mean, that's what I see.
And I pulled Lori aside and I said, Lori, I am telling you, I don't want you to ever have anyone underestimate the value of a host.
Right.
You kicked ass.
Sure.
Our girl show. Yeah. She was unbelievable.
Some people really want to move out of that host phase super fast. But to me, hosting is the closest thing to headlining in that the commitment level has
to be. That's why I said on certain shows, and Boston Comedy Festival is one of the big kahunas, you know, in the country.
I'd say top three.
And on every showcase, that is a headliner hosts a showcase.
Mm-hmm.
He has nobody, only headliners. If you're hosting a showcase, you're a headliner.
Right.
And it, the same thing when you watch even Def Comedy Jam. It's who's hosting? D.L. Hughley. Who's hosting?
That's very Canadian, though, right?
Yeah.
Like where the big name
look,
comes
who's
in.
Who's hosting?
Who
they put headliners in to host. It's the same thing on that show.
I'd say I modeled my MC career, which I'm not fully out of. I still have MC dates. I'm MCing this week in Liberty for Rob Schneider. But,
oh, congratulations.
Well, thank you. It'll be my third tour with the man. And he gave me a lot of great advice when I first started. And when I first started with him, he was a different comic than he is today. Because when I first started with him, he was just getting back on the road. And he was very, you could tell in his personal life, not as settled as he was. Like the next time I worked with him, first time I worked with him, short hair, glasses. I mean, Michael Jordan, as far as how meticulous his suit was, it was just very trim and proper, went up on stage and was very kind of dry, but entertaining, sold $15,000 worth of t-shirts.
Wow.
Allegedly, if any IRS people are listening. This was like 20 years ago, so it's like a long time. Statute of limitations is definitely run out. But, but then the next time I worked with him, he shows up with no merch, shows up in a unbuttoned, he's wearing a suit, but the shirt's untucked, buttons come down, it's almost butterfly, his hair's grown out again. I mean, straight out of one of his movies, basically, but super, hey, Adrian. Whereas the first time he was like, you haven't asked me any questions, but I'm going to tell you all the questions you should have asked, and here's the answers to them. So, like, that's how his, because we didn't spend it. The first time it was very business. He didn't come until like 5 minutes before he started, but he still gave me what I needed, even though I didn't know what I needed to ask. Second time, we're just buds. He's friendly. He has no merch. He still signs all the DVDs and everything that people bring, shuts down the showroom on Friday for the first show. And Saturday first show, so that people don't have to leave and go out and wait with the other people while he's signing. So just does it all. The show starts late because they can't.
He appreciates his fans.
Yeah. He knows where his bread is buttered.
Exactly, appreciating your fans is huge. Every email I get, every message I get, I return everything. I never, never, always, I mean, I never disrespect a fan.
I spent $60 today sending t-shirts out for free to people that listen to my podcast who had asked for t-shirts. And so I didn't really spend $60 today, but I sent these t-shirts out before, and then it occurred to me that I did the postage wrong. And they all got returned to my last address in Chicago, but I would have to pay to get those shirts back from Chicago. They wouldn't board them for me. So like, just keep those. You can open them. I don't care what you do. I'll resend them.
So you'll have all these people walking around Chicago.
Well, yeah, totally unrelated. They're totally
They'll end up at the shelter.
I'm really big in the people that bum for cigarettes community.
Right, but some guy at the subway. You know, well, what do they call it? It's not the subway in Chicago. It's
the L, yeah. They got
the above line. Yeah. Walking.
It was one of those things where it was like, if anybody,
walking around with your t-shirt,
the tens of people that listen to my podcast, to connect with them, to be able to give them something that says thank you for even listening, because I don't know what it is that has anybody become a fan of anybody. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's just like when I have people, you know, fans in the audience or an audience member, and they'll say, oh, it's my birthday, and I have a hat and I just give it to them.
Yeah.
But the greatest compliment you can get is when someone goes out of their way to tell you what a wonderful time they had. You know, I was on a show on Long Island, and a woman came up to me and she said, I'm a caregiver, and my client had a stroke, and I thought my client was unable to laugh due to her stroke, but tonight I saw her laugh. So you don't make.
Wow, that's a breakthrough.
So of course
moment.
I was like, here's a t-shirt.
Yeah.
And when she came out, I said to the woman, I said, I heard you had a wonderful time tonight, and I thank you so much for coming. Those are made, or just when somebody come, I had another woman come up to me that, you know, my husband died a year ago, and tonight was the first time I laughed in a year. That's huge to me.
Yeah.
Because you're like, you don't even realize what you're doing for people.
Right.
The gift that, it could have been one joke in 45 minutes, maybe the woman laughed at.
Sure, yeah.
But it didn't matter. And, you know that it doesn't matter which one it was. You know, they had a good time within that time.
I want to end on this. That is so true. It is really what makes it all worth it to me at the end of the day. And I remember watching an episode of Golden Girls where she was talking, Dorothy?
Dorothy. Bea Arthur?
The main character, the tall, white...
Yeah. Bea Arthur.
She says, she's describing a story. I'll see if I can find a clip. I'll play it at the end of the episode where she's talking about a death that had happened. And that she was emotionless when it had happened. And then she went to watch a movie, and she laughed through the whole movie. Just laughed and laughed and laughed and laughed. And then she went home by herself, and she cried and cried and cried and cried. And what I got present to in that moment of that story, just on a television show, why that show was so great, was I thought, wow, she really needed to laugh in order to get the other thing.
Exactly.
You never know where you're meeting these people at in their lives. And I've met comics that I think are jerks to me, and I don't know where they're at in their lives. You know what I mean? And I've said things on the podcast about these people, and I realized at the end of the day, you know, we're all meeting each other at a very vulnerable point in any given moment in our life on this timeline thing. But we get to do this great thing where we get to give a gift to somebody that doesn't even know they need it. And when you get to, and when they tell you, It's almost the same thing as when somebody says, I really like the podcast. I've never listened to a podcast before. I've never been to a stand-up show before. It's like, no matter how many shit shows you've done in a row, you get that one comment sometimes. It's like hitting the perfect golf ball, the perfect whatever it is you're into.
Well, it's taking this gift we've been given and sharing it.
Sharing in general.
Sharing. is sharing this gift.
Thank you for sharing, Linda Belt.
Thank you, Adrian, for having me.
An experience. I was talking about you on the podcast, and when I was last episode, and I said, you know what, let me write this down, see if she's available. I don't know how long she's in town.
Thank you for asking.
Why talk about her? Let her talk to the people.
Oh, thank you so much. And to the Dayton peeps, thank you so much. I'd like to say to you, to everybody in Dayton who has embraced me in this city, as somebody from Hartford via New Jersey, I thank you very much for the Midwest hospitality, and I just appreciate my fans out here. Thank you so much.
Guys, Linda Belt, check her out. Pitch your social media for us so we know where to find you online.
LindaBelt.com.
LindaBelt.com.
LindaBelt.com will have all my links to Facebook, Instagram. Just find me there.
I know I have some new listeners in Hartford from when I was just there a couple weeks ago. So if you see the name pop up in your Facebook feed, because Linda and I are friends.
Yeah.
Now you will be friends with Linda.
Yeah, Hartford
Go check
peeps.
Out the show.
I live in Bloomfield, Hartford peeps. If yeah. there was, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, right next door.
It's all there. We're all family. I'm endorsing her. She's endorsing me. If you like my comedy, you'll like her comedy 10 times more. I guarantee
it. Oh, stop.
It. She's a professional. I am just an amateur. She is a longshoreman. I fish from the pier.
The amateur who's opening for Rob Schneider. But okay. We'll stick with that story.
We all have our crossed
up
there.
Yeah.
Thank you, Linda.
Thank you so much. What a pleasure. Thanks
awesome.
Again.
my way.